Hello, everyone. I hope you all had a good 2 weeks since we last spoke. This week on the show, I had Professor Naomi Lamoureux. Naomi is Professor of Economics and History at Yale University and a Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Today, we talk a lot about mergers. She has written a great deal about that subject, and in particular, her book, The Great Merger Movement in American Business, 1895 to 1904, is a good reference point here. We also talk towards the end of the show about her article in the Journal of Economic Perspectives in 2019. The title of that article was The Problem of Bigness from Standard Oil to Google. Another nice reference for this conversation is her article in the American Economic Review in 1998 called Partnerships, Corporations, and the Theory of the Firm. I learned a great deal from this conversation. I hope you do too. If you're listening from Ireland today, happy Bloom's Day. Have a good week. I'll see you in two. Take care of yourselves. Professor Naomi Lamoureux, thank you so much for agreeing to do this with us on the Economic History Podcast. I'd like to start off by asking you how you got into economic history in the first place.
By accident, I think I would have to say. I went to college with the idea of majoring in math, and I went to the University of Wisconsin. It was the time of the war in Vietnam. There were huge protests, lots going on. And when I got there and started taking my math classes, the math classes seemed so isolated, so abstracted from everything that was going on. So I decided I couldn't be a math major. I needed to do something that was more connected with what was going on in the world. And I tried a number of different things, took lots of different courses, and ultimately settled on history and went to graduate school in history. And it was really when I started graduate school working with Lou Galambos, who was a business historian and political historian, that I figured out that I wanted to do economic history. He had me read some of the new economic historians, people like Robert Fogel. And I got really excited because that allowed me to combine my original interest in mathematics with history in a productive way. And so then I got very excited, and that was that. Never looked back.
And along the way, Naomi, did you come across any literature or a paper or a book that inspired you?
Yes. Well, the original work by people like Fogel and Albert Fishlow attracted me to the field, but the piece of work that to me signals the reason I found this so exciting and engaging is Gavin Wright's Political Economy of the Cotton South. So that is a book that was written in that period of time in the middle of the 70s when everybody was all engaged in the debate over time in the cross and the debate over slavery. But it's different from the other pieces of work on that subject. It has quantitative empirical work, but it's primarily a product of very, very clear thinking. So what Gavin was able to do, which I think no one else has ever done as well, is to take a simple economic model and use it to capture the complexity of history. That seems like a paradox, but he is absolutely able to do it, to characterize human behavior in a complex way, but using simple economic models to do it. And what the book is really is an analytic narrative that links together a series of very simple models and explains an enormous amount about the South and the slave South, the institution of slavery, how it worked economically, its limits in the 19th century.
Moving from that to your own work, you've written a lot about corporations, firms, the history of them. Can we start off today's chat by defining what a firm is? And maybe we could kind of locate the time or the point in time where the beginnings of the modern firm starts to emerge.
I'm chuckling because that's probably the hardest question you could ask. So how you define a firm depends on what approach you're coming from. So I think in common English usage, when we think of a firm, we use that term to be synonymous with a business enterprise. And so we have in mind something that has multiple owners, usually, though not always, and employees and engages in some kind of economic activity. If you approach the subject from the standpoint of economics, it can get even more complicated because in neoclassical economics, a firm was just essentially an equation-solving entity. It could be a person, it could be a group of persons, but it's treated as just something that solves equations, that it maximizes profit by equating marginal revenue and marginal cost. And that's what a firm is. And then other branches of economics have had more complicated notions of the firm. So the most exciting was Ronald Coase, who in the 1930s, in an article that was overlooked for several decades, asked the question, well, how do firms differ from markets? And so he defined a firm as essentially an implicit contract that gave one entity, one economic actor, power over another, the ability to determine what that other entity, what that other agent did. So the classic example was that he offered was the employment relationship. If you could hire someone in the market and you hire a person to do a very specific thing, but in the real world, and when you actually are employing that person, that contract is not good enough because it may be that there are lots of things you couldn't describe in the contract or lots of contingencies that come up. And so we have a different kind of contract instead, which is that X person works for Y person gets to, within a range, a specified range, decide what X does. And that, to Coase, that discretion in that relationship was what defined a firm. So in the market, everything has to be spelled out. There's a contract that all the terms have to be explicit. But in a firm, the relationship is squishier. You have a lot of room for improvisation, again, within boundaries. So today, it's not appropriate to ask your employee to get you coffee or take your clothes to the dry cleaner, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of discretion over what your employee can do. And that's a firm in Coase's sense. And then there's the legal definition of a firm, which is that the law will, and increasingly is very articulate on this, that law will specify what a firm is, what the contractual relations of the parties are. So what a partnership is, what a corporation is, what a limited liability company is, and so on.
We can get into that now about what actually distinguished a partnership from, say, a joint stock company, and how are business owners exposed to their own personal wealth?
So in the standard partnership, what you might call the simple partnership or the ordinary partnership, especially under Anglo-American law, anyone who appears in the world to be doing business with another person, anyone who shares in profits with another person is engaged in a partnership and is fully liable, individually fully liable for all debts of that enterprise. And so the risk that a partner faces in that kind of enterprise is that the other partner will encumber the firm in ways that he or she does not approve of, get the firm into trouble, and then the partner will be liable for those mistakes. So that's a classic partnership. A joint stock company is historically a partnership, but with multiple people. So it has a more elaborate contract governing it, where people will put a certain amount into the enterprise, and the contract will also specify some rules about how those people will behave towards each other, what they're allowed to do. Now, the problem under Anglo-American law is that that's a contract among the parties, so that if one member of the firm violates it and encumbers the firm with an outside party, all the partners are still liable because the outside party cannot be expected to know the secret details of the partnership contract. That's under Anglo-American law. So the corporate form was a solution to that. It required and still requires a grant from the state. In historically, that grant was an individual act. There had to be a legislative act or a grant from the king. But today, of course, it's a simple registration process. But when you form a corporation, then that changes the liability structure of the enterprise so that you can have limited liability and you can ensure concentrated management so that an individual member of the firm does not have the right to bind a corporation unless that individual member has been elected to an administrative office in the corporation. Whereas in a partnership or a joint stock company that is really a partnership, you don't have that kind of protection. Now that's Anglo-American law. Under the French code or the German code, it's very different. You can actually have binding contracts among members of the firm that are enforceable. So in a French partnership after the Napoleonic Code, if there's a contract saying you cannot enter into debts alone on behalf of the firm and you do, the outside party cannot enforce the debt contract against the firm. So Anglo-American law offers much fewer protections than French law or German law historically. And the only way to get protections under Anglo-American law was to form a corporation. So I've been emphasizing the benefits of the corporation over the partnership. But the corporation itself entails costs.
Yeah.
So because a corporation has concentrated management, that means whoever owns a majority of the shares in a one share, one vote corporation, there's many ways of organizing a corporation, but the typical corporation under American law is a one share, one vote corporation. And in that, whoever has 51% of the shares is dictator.
Yeah.
So there's a famous law case that Jean-Laurent Rosenthal and I cite in our work called Burden v. Burden. The Burdens were brothers, and they inherited an ironworks from their father. One of the brothers had knowledge of how to run a steelworks. The other did not. And they were originally a partnership. And the brother that didn't have any knowledge was just a pain in the neck. So the brother that had knowledge said, okay, I'm out of here unless you change this form to a corporation and I have a controlling share. So they did that because the steelworks would have been worthless without the managerial expertise of the one brother. The other brother would just have had to sell out. And then the brother who was the minority interest later feels that his brother is taking advantage of him and he sues in court. And the judge says, sorry, you knew what you were getting into. Your brother has the controlling interest. You're just stuck. You have to put up with it unless your brother is engaging in fraud. And there's no evidence that he is behaving fraudulently. You're stuck. You're a minority shareholder. Your brother has control.
Yeah, that's a nice anecdote.
So firmness is a complicated thing, right? So I really like the work of Henry Hansman and various co-authors on this, where they look at what's really important for a modern firm. That is, what are the attributes that you need to to undertake the complicated activities that modern firms have to undertake, the highly capital intensive, but very firm specific investments. And so they argue that there's two aspects that really matter. One they call owner shielding, which is what we call limited liability. But the one they think is really important is what they call entity shielding. And I think their work is really important for bringing this to the forefront of our attention. So what entity shielding is shielding the assets of the enterprise from creditors of the members of the enterprise.
Okay.
So if you're in a partnership and you're with a partner in a partnership with a partner that goes bankrupt, the firm's assets can be seized. Your business can be ruined by the creditors of your partner. So it's really important to have entity shielding, protection of the assets in the enterprise from claims on the partners. And that's what a corporation does. Once money is put in the corporation, it's there, it's sunk. The no member of the firm can take it out, and no creditor of a member of the firm has any claim on it except the claim on the share of the profits that the member would get through dividends or through other distributions. So the enterprise is protected, and that's really what a corporation does. That's what an LLC does.
Yeah, it's almost a separation of powers between the individual and the machine or the firm itself.
Right. And so that's the way you would think of firmness, right? Yeah. That it's that separation that gives an enterprise that independent identity.
And you have worked extensively on the firm merger movement. You wrote a book on it, in fact. What were the prime forces that drove the what you call urge to merge in the later 19th century in, say, the US?
In that book, The Great Merger Movement and American Business, I set up this complicated historical confluence of things. But I think there's a really simple answer to your question, which is they're merging to escape competition, pure and simple.
Okay, wow, that was...
It was a period of really intense price competition. And really what my book was about was trying to explain why price competition was so intense in that period of time. But given that it was so intense, what the mergers are, pure and simple, is an attempt to escape competition.
Okay, so then taking that one step further, what then was the impact of the larger mergers on the economy, and how did it usher in a sort of a managerial revolution?
Well, many of the firms that were formed to escape competition didn't succeed.
Yeah.
Some, they faced new competition. They had no particular advantages over new entrants. And so their market shares declined. Many of them failed. Large numbers of those mergers failed, but some of them persisted. And the question is sort of why were they able to maintain their positions over time? Well, Alfred D. Chandler Jr., who's the great business historian of that period, argued that they were able to succeed because they did things that made them more efficient than their competitors or gave them advantages over their competitors in ways that were good for the economy. So he focused on things like vertically integrating backwards into raw materials, forwards into distribution, and developing a managerial hierarchy that enabled managers to manage these multi-unit enterprises efficiently. Now, I think there's, you know, some validity to Chandler's views, but what I always emphasized instead that there were also attempts to do this by more nefarious means, by getting assets, obtaining assets, or doing things that allow the firm to erect barriers to competition. So my best example of that in my book was U.S. Steel, which essentially bought up or leased the lion's share of the ore resources in the United States. So competitors really had no ore resources, and the only way they could get a foothold would be to import ore from other regions of the world. But that's a higher cost venture, and so they start with a disadvantage.
Yeah. And what's the outcome then?
What's the outcome? Well, U.S. Steel was able to get away with that. And as a result, in the United States, the steel industry was a tight oligopoly with just a small number of producers until the recent period. Now, the real problem with having a tight oligopoly is that without the pressure of competition, it's not very innovative. And that, as we know, that's the story of the American steel industry. The steel firms got kind of fat and dumb under this protection from controlling ore resources. And gradually, steel enterprises that were much more innovative developed in the rest of the world. And so you got these incredibly innovative firms in Japan and other places, Korea, around the world. And ultimately, the American steel industry collapsed under competition from these foreign producers. You know, the American steel industry tried to adopt some of the technologies that were exploited quite effectively abroad, like basic oxygen furnaces. I remember when I was a beginning business historian, we had a business history conference in Lehigh, Pennsylvania, and as part of the conference, we toured the Bethlehem Steelworks there. And they had basic oxygen furnaces, but because they were so afraid of competition pushing down the price of steel, they only operated them alternately. So in other words, they only operated them at half capacity. And they explained this to us when we were on the tour. It was amazing. So that's a recipe for disaster.
Wow.
Competition is important. I guess I would underscore that point.
Absolutely. We had the example there of steel, where you had a monopoly. What about other sectors? Were there instances of, say, collusion after this big merger movement, like you suggest, because these companies were merging to escape price competition?
Oh, there's plenty. They try everything to wreck barriers to entry. There are many different strategies that firms used in this period of time. They formed pools that are essentially price fixing agreements or agreements to limit competition. The window glass consolidation actually formed an agreement with the glassworkers union at that time to limit the supply of skilled labor to firms that were not part of the consolidation. They use patents, just anything you can think of that might be a source of a barrier to competition.
Any headline industries that were notorious for this?
For patents, it would be General Electric and Westinghouse and firms like that. They had ways of essentially cross-licensing patents to each other that prevented them from blocking each other's activities in their own territories, but made it very difficult for new competitors to get a foothold. The meat packers are another one. I spend a lot of time talking about them in my article, The Problem of Bigness. And I'm drawing on Mary Yeager's work for that. She's a business historian of about the same vintage as I am. And she wrote early on in her career a really superb book on the meatpackers that just documented the collusion that they engaged in the attempt to limit competition.
Okay, now you've given us examples of the key sectors, but you also, in your work, say that in general, these attempts rarely did succeed. Why was this the case?
The attempts succeed because they're usually efforts to limit competition in ways that are difficult, or it's possible to find alternatives. So I gave you just some examples of pretty successful ones. Another example of an unsuccessful one would be paper. International Paper tried the same strategy as Standard Oil, tried to monopolize woodlands so that there was not as much supply of cheap wood pulp to competitors. But that was a quixotic exercise. The woodlands of North America are vast.
Yeah.
And then, of course, government policy matters too, right? Government prevented certain strategies that had been effective. Without government intervention, they would have been effective. Like Standard Oil grew large by getting rebates from railroads, and the government made that illegal.
Also in your work, you talk a lot about antitrust law. Can we just briefly, before we move forward, talk about what the motivation is behind them and what they actually are?
Sure. So Americans have, from the very beginning, been worried about monopoly. But the source of monopoly historically was not large private businesses, but government. So through most of American history, the real threat to competition was that the government would grant a monopoly privilege to a particular firm. And it was mainly state governments that did that. The federal government didn't engage in much of that kind of activity, with a few notable exceptions, right? The First Bank of the United States, the Second Bank of the United States, and a few transcontinental railroads after the Civil War. But states did that. They granted all these charters. They might be corporate charters, but they would have monopoly privileges embedded in, maybe the right to build a bridge or a right to build a canal or a right to build a railroad. And these would have monopoly privileges associated with them. So there's, in the middle of the 19th century, a tremendous revolt against that kind of government largesse. That's where our general incorporation laws come from. They were attempts to prevent the government, state governments, from granting these monopoly privileges. And in these laws that were passed, these general incorporation laws, there's all kinds of provisions in the initial laws that aim to prevent private firms from getting unfair advantages over other private firms. So there were limits on the size of corporations. There were limits on the amount they could borrow. There were also protections against mergers. It wasn't really at all easy under the initial general incorporation laws for two businesses to merge. So Standard Oil is a really innovative enterprise. John G. Rockefeller, with the help of some really creative lawyers, most notably S.C.T. Dodd, come up with a way of using private contracts to merge all the enterprises in the petroleum industry, or virtually all the enterprises in the petroleum industry. And what they use is something called a voting trust device, where the shareholders of a firm will essentially transfer control over that firm to a board of trustees. And they get trust certificates in exchange. And so they get their share of the profits of the firm through those trust certificates. But the firm then votes and runs the enterprise on behalf of the shareholders. And Standard Oil created a huge trust that essentially had all these voting rights for all these individual petroleum firms. And so that was an end run around these state general incorporation laws. And the states, people got very upset by this in the states. The same people who had been, same kinds of people who had been upset about monopolies in general. And so they began to pass what were called antitrust laws that were specifically designed to make these kinds of arrangements illegal. And while they were at it, they made any kinds of similar arrangements that monopolized an industry illegal. So the first ones were passed by individual states. There's maybe a dozen of them. And then the federal government comes in 1890 with the passage of a similar act, the Sherman Antitrust Act. and then the rest of the states pretty much follow suit. So that's the origin of the antitrust laws. This end run that Standard Oil engaged in to avoid the restrictions that were written into state general incorporation laws.
Were there differences? Was there a good, such thing as a good or a bad trust?
So at the time, after the passage of the Sherman Act, some people thought that the act was too broad, too general, that it attacked all trusts, all combinations, and that some combinations might be good combinations in the sense that they achieved efficiencies in scale or scope that really benefited Americans. So what people at the time tried to do is look at how a firm grew big. And if it grew big by nefarious means, so Standard Oil forced companies to sell out to it by getting rebates from railroads that allowed them to ruin companies that didn't agree to sell out to it. So that was considered nefarious. But if a firm grew large just because it had a superior product or was a more efficient producer, then people thought that they should not be broken up, and they called those firms good trusts. And Teddy Roosevelt is the famous one for trying to do this. He's president of the United States. He thinks the Sherman Act is too broad. He says there's good trusts, there's bad trusts. We should break up the bad trusts, but we should encourage the good trusts. And he wanted to set up a government apparatus that would enable him to conduct investigations and decide what trusts were good and what trusts were bad. And that was the initial mission of the Bureau of Corporations. It's a hard thing to do, though, because as the point that I'm making in my article on bigness is that some firms grow really large because they're more efficient or they have a new product that people want, but then they often behave badly. That is, they often turn to nefarious means to protect their positions. And so good trusts can easily use bad tools to preserve their position. So there really aren't good trusts or bad trusts. Firms in general want to escape competition.
Of course.
And the goal of policy is to prevent that.
Yes. And then in that same paper, you talk about the new Brandeisians of today. Who are they and what are their concerns?
Well, so there are a number of people. The most prominent people are probably Lena Khan, who wrote a very widely read article in the Yale Law Review about Amazon and is now going to be on the Federal Trade Commission. And then Tim Wu, who wrote a recent book, which is quite widely read and is a columnist periodically for the New York Times, or at least writes op-eds periodically for the New York Times. So they're the most prominent. And what they are doing is sounding the alarm about the size of big firms in the economy today, like Amazon and Google and Facebook. And they're saying, wake up, wake up. Danger, danger, we need to do something about these firms. They call themselves the new Brandeisians because Brandeis was, Louis Brandeis, who was a lawyer, publicist, later Supreme Court justice, had sounded the alarm in the second decade of the 20th century about the money trust. And one of the chapters of his book on the money trust is called The Curse of Bigness. And they have picked that up as a kind of a mantra that bigness is dangerous.
Do they have any validity, those arguments, according to your perspective?
So, yes, that is, large firms can have more options. They have more muscle that they can use, if not checked, to limit competition. Where I disagree with them, I think they're right that there are real dangers in the current economy. Where I disagree with them is they want to adopt a remedy which essentially says bigness is bad. When firms get too large, they should be broken up. I worry that that policy is not good for innovation. So I would prefer a policy that focuses on the conduct of large firms and punishes them when they take actions that erect barriers to competition. Not punish them for being big, but punish them for things they do that might be unfair competitive practices.
In the time that you looked at before, that Standard Oil Trust was seen as, quote, a monster that corrupted politicians and laid waste to its competitors, unquote. Can you tell us the story about that company, the legislation, the outcome?
Standard Oil gets big because it's able to manipulate some rebates from railroads. And by manipulating those rebates from railroads, it goes from having about 4% of the refinery production in the U.S. in 1870 to about 90% 10 years later. I mean, that's an amazing story, but it's a really nefarious one. And then once it's big, there are other dangers of bigness that we need to worry about. For example, Standard Oil does seem to engage in a lot of practices that we would regard as politically dangerous. There are all kinds of accounts. Don't know how true they are because these things are very hard to document, of bribery and corruption in state legislatures and in the Congress as well. What we do have evidence of is intimidation, attempts at intimidation. So I can give you a couple of examples. One, the Attorney General of Ohio. So Standard Oil was originally an Ohio corporation. And when the Attorney General of Ohio learned about the Standard Oil Trust, the Attorney General said this was an illegal move under the state's general incorporation laws, and he filed suit in the Ohio Supreme Court to abrogate the charter of the Standard Oil Company. And when he does this, he is approached. Actually, we have copies of the letters. They're in writing by Mark Hanna, where Mark Hanna is a big political boss in Ohio and a Republican political boss. And Hanna essentially says, hey, if you want to have a political future, you should stop this suit. So another example we have is from Kansas. This I haven't published yet. This is in an article that's probably be published in a book soon. But when Kansas files an antitrust suit against Standard Oil, and Standard Oil then decides, Kansas has oil at that period of time. So the initial oil production in the U.S. was in Pennsylvania. And then gradually they discover other oil resources in other parts of the center of the country. And then later on, you get the big oil field discoveries in Texas and in California. But Kansas had oil in the late 19th century. And Standard says, we're not going to do business with any oil producer in Kansas as long as this antitrust suit is going forward. They actually publicly, and it turned out to be a huge public relations disaster. They realized it was a mistake. They give up on it really quickly, but lots of suits. Lots of other states responded to the threat to Kansas by initiating antitrust prosecutions and joining the Kansas suit.
So as you mentioned already, concerns about bigness are very much with us in contemporary times. Can you offer an overview of the evidence about whether such bigness in general is positive or negative to the economy? You've touched on monopolies already and everything like that, but is there empirical evidence to show any positive or negative impact on the performance of the economy?
Well, historically, we see a lot of evidence that firms that are able to entrench monopoly positions like U.S. Steel become less innovative over time, and that it takes a long time, but that's ultimately disastrous for the economy. But on the other hand, we also see that firms that come up with new innovations that are really important for the economy, like Google, for example, or Amazon, can grow very, very large. And so the real problem to sort out is how do we prevent large firms that grow large because they've been so innovative, how do we prevent them from doing damage to the economy of the order that U.S. Steel represents? And the answer is I think we need to be very vigilant about their practices and absolutely punish them for engaging in anti-competitive practices. So, you know, when Google, for example, makes using its Android phone operating system contingent on giving primacy to Google search engine, that's a bad thing. When Google uses its search engine to advantage other aspects of its business, that's a bad thing. And those are practices that I think come under the current antitrust laws, that we have the wherewithal to move against those kinds of practices. The other thing that we really haven't talked about that is important and tricky is whether firms with these enormous resources are threats to democracy in the way that Standard Oil was a threat to democracy. Now, I personally believe that the antitrust laws are not the right protections against those kinds of threats, but that we have other tools, or we could have other tools that helped us guard against those threats. So right now we're in a pretty bad situation in the U.S. because our laws, our campaign finance laws, have been weakened by Supreme Court decisions. But it seems that the country could, if it had the will, if it worried about these things sufficiently, perhaps by constitutional amendment, declare that money is not speech and that we can have limits on campaign finance that don't run afoul of the First Amendment. And we can also have much tighter restrictions on lobbying. Google is spending an enormous amount on lobbying, and so is Facebook, and so is Amazon, and we could have better protections against those kinds of expenditures. So I think the antitrust laws are not the appropriate remedy there, but that there are remedies that we should be thinking seriously about and adopting.
Naomi, thank you very much for your time today. I've really enjoyed this chat and you sharing your expertise on these matters. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for your interest.